Alrighty, today is the 11th of something. Oh, April, that's right. And we are in the middle of, in some ways, one of the most fascinating parts of the Quran. I saved it for last because I knew it would be quite, you know, pretty interesting for us. And that has to do with jihad. And, of course, there's a lot. Ever since 9/11, there's all sorts of stuff about jihad that you read here and there, both apologetic on the part of Islam or attacking on the part of, say, conservative Christians and so forth. And so what we've been doing is I think I've got a complete inventory of references to jihad or cognate ideas. At least I tried to make it as complete as I could. This is all I know of. And I started reading the selections last time. And if you weren't here last time, maybe you were able to listen to the recording. At any rate, one of the very interesting facts about the references to jihad in the Quran is that only one of the, whatever, I counted, 21 or something like that, different references to jihad is from the any of the Meccan periods. Everything else, the other 20, are all from the Medinan and final period of Muhammad's life. Remember, we divided up the surahs in the Quran into four groups. We have the early Meccan, the middle Meccan, the late Meccan. And there's not that much difference between the three. They are mostly tied into significant events in Muhammad's life. But as far as doctrine goes, well, I don't think there's a whole lot of variation in the Quran as a whole, but especially in those, there's not a whole lot, seems to me. But then when you get to the Medinan period, things are a little bit different, because you remember that Muhammad fled to Medina in, 622, and at this point, open warfare had broken out between his native Mecca and Medina, which apparently, where apparently he could find more allies than in his native Mecca. And you may remember that initially the Meccans attacked the Medinans, hoping to snuff out this heresy before it got too far, and failed. They were defeated. And then the Medinans thought, well, now we have the opportunity to do the opposite, and they attacked the Meccans, and they failed. And then there was this truce that lasted for a few years, and then it was violated, and then warfare broke out again. This time, the Medinan forces managed to capture Mecca, and then they went on, before Muhammad died, to take over most of the Arabian Peninsula. But anyway, the point is, once the Muhammad had fled to Medina, the context was different. It was more of a violent world all of a sudden. I mean, before, Muhammad had to preach and talk to people or preach to people things they didn't want to hear. They did not want to abstain, or they didn't want to abolish their traditional worship of many gods and accept Muhammad's radical monotheism. And so there's a lot of resistance there. He was sort of a persona non grata for a number of years in Mecca. But up to that point, there was really no violence. But then once you get to the Medinan period, then, and you're talking about the last 10 years of Muhammad's life, then, yeah, we are talking about, constant warfare, basically. So,
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I thought the idea of a chronological description of the different surahs was only one scholarly opinion. They're not chronological in the Quran itself. Is this chronological business accepted by most scholars?
The chronology I have been following is sort of the standard chronology, the traditional chronology. Other scholars have tried to establish other chronologies. To my way of thinking, and this is just sort of an informal, look at it. I haven't looked at it in that much detail, but there's a lot of similarity between chronologies that I have seen. They differ in matters of detail, but I think that there's a rough general agreement as to the chronology of the surahs. So, as I say, I've just been following, kind of the standard one. If you look at my spreadsheet, one of the tabs in the spreadsheet is chronology, I think. And, I lay it out along the traditional path. But even alternatives, as I say, I do not disagree, enormously, I think, with the original traditional chronology. So you might say there's kind of at a very high level, sort of a general agreement. Yeah. The Quran, of course, makes no claim to be chronological. The Quran itself, as you pointed out, I mean, the surahs are all, I just want to make sure this is on. The surahs are all, we talk about why are the surahs arranged the way they are, and one possibility is that the more mature surahs, perhaps, are put front and center because, they were deemed to be maybe the most important. I don't know. But at any rate, I think it's instructive, and as I have said since the very beginning, I think it's very instructive to look at the surahs chronologically, and especially so with jihad, because you can see then why in the later surahs the whole theme of jihad is much, much more prevalent than it is in the Meccan surahs, because indeed that's what was going on at the time. And a lot of the surahs, I think, do reflect Muhammad's own circumstances. And even when he's talking about Moses or, whoever, a lot of the time I think that's sort of reflective of Muhammad's own, the things he encountered. So anyway, last time I read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 5 or 7 or so of the passages dealing with jihad. And in the context of our discussion so far, we have mentioned 4 possible interpretations of jihad. So I thought I would go over those first. And because when all this is over, I want to take a vote and see what you think. And maybe there's a 5th or 6th possibility. I don't know. But the 4 possibilities, and some of them I mentioned just at the very beginning, because these are things that you find, online and stuff. The 4 possibilities are, number one, the anti-Muslim theory. What should I call it? The congenital disease theory, that jihad or violence is essential to Islam, that you can't have Islam without violence. Islam is essentially and congenitally a violent religion. Okay, that's what you read on the anti-Islamic websites or publications or what have you. At the opposite extreme, number 2, jihad is psychological. It's a matter of the heart. It's a matter of waging war in the heart, waging a war against vice in preference to virtue. So that's I think this came out in our discussion last time, by the way, clearly an allegorical reading of, what's going on with the various references to jihad in the Quran. That's number 2. Number 3, you read this a lot. Jihad is the Islamic version of, say, Thomas Aquinas' just war theory. So it's really all about, just as Aquinas accepts the accepts the reality of war and simply tries to diminish its horrors by insisting on certain rules in conducting warfare. So in the Quran, all the references to jihad are designed to mitigate the horrors of war. So it's sort of the equivalent of just war theory. The fourth possibility is mentioned by Pat Nevins-Locke near the end of the class last time. And it's a little bit like number one, but still subtly different. That jihad stuff is like crusader of the crusades, or you might call it the mosque militant theory. There's Bob. I'll call it the mosque militant theory, the theory that we Muslims are justified in waging war, and we're not going to stop until the world finally adopts Islam. So that's not saying it's necessarily endemic to Islam, but rather that we have a duty to make sure that the world eventually, at sometime in the future, is converted to Islam. So the four theories are that violence is endemic to Islam, the congenital disease theory, the psychological theory is nothing but a matter of waging war in the heart, the just war interpretation, that it's really just an attempt to mitigate the horrors of warfare, and number four, the crusader or the mosque militant theory, that the purpose of jihad is to convert the world to Islam, and then we don't need to engage in it anymore. Okay, so those are the four possibilities so far. Now, we're going to read some more, and some more maybe will occur to you as we go along, and if so, please voice them. Because at the end of the day, I want us to sort of take a vote and see what we think about how this should all be interpreted. So as I said...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Go.
Don, since the Quran endorses the idea of jihad,
mm-hmm.
it would seem like it would be in the interests of people who want to cause trouble to use that as an excuse to fit whatever they want to do into one of those covers. Like, for example, Don, if all I want to do is conquer my neighboring countries because mm-hmm. I'm an expansionist,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
One or more of those categories you just listed gives me cover.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Oh, sure. I have no doubt that, Al-Qaeda and ISIS can, open right up in the Quran and say, look here, if you're wavering, here's what your, holy text says. You have an obligation to wage jihad. And by the way, if you put on an explosive vest and blow yourself up and kill untold numbers of the enemy, you will be rewarded in the afterlife. You'll have, the whole deal, all that stuff. Sure,
well,
no question.
I was thinking of a relatively more benign case.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Arabian Peninsula in the Mideast is not very good land and all that. And so, they got their sights set on Europe, like Spain and Southern Europe,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
as a much better place, fertile and all that.
Yeah,
they just wanted the land and they don't really care that much about Islam.
Sure. Religious texts are subject to exploitation. No question about that. Provides cover, provides a rationalization. Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, let me go on then. Now, the next one is 8-2. They ask thee concerning the spoils of war. Say, the spoils belong to Allah and the Messenger. It's convenient. So fear Allah and set things right among yourselves and obey Allah and His Messenger if you are believers. Spoils of war. Next one. Same surah, 13 through 20. Okay, here we go. When thy Lord revealed to the angels, saying, I am with you, so give firmness to those who believe. I will cast terror into the hearts of those who disbelieve. Smite then the upper parts of their necks and smite off their fingertips. That is because they have opposed Allah and His Messenger. And whoso opposes Allah and His Messenger, then Allah is surely severe in retribution. That is your punishment. Taste it then, and know that for disbelievers there is the punishment of the fire. O ye who believe, when you meet those who disbelieve advancing in force, turn not your backs to them. And whoso turns his back to them on such a day, unless maneuvering for battle or turning to join another company, he indeed draws upon himself the wrath of Allah, and hell shall be his abode, and an evil resort it is. So you killed them not, but it was Allah who killed them. And thou threwest not when thou didst throw, but it was Allah who threw, that he might overthrow the disbelievers, and that he might confer on the believers a great favor from himself. Surely Allah is all-hearing, all-knowing. That is what happened, and know that Allah is he who weakens the design of the disbelievers. If you sought a judgment, then judgment has indeed come to you, and if you desist, it will be better for you. But if you return to hostility, we too will return, and your party shall be of no avail at all to you, however numerous it be, and know that Allah is with the believers. Okay. And still in Surah number 8, 57 through 76. Okay. Those with whom thou didst make a covenant, then they break their covenant every time, and they do not fear God. So if thou catchest them in war, then by routing them strike fear in those that are behind them, that they may all be admonished. And if thou fearest treachery from a people, throw back to them their covenant with equity. Surely Allah loves not the treacherous. And let not those who disbelieve think that they have outstripped us. Surely they cannot frustrate God's purpose. And make ready for them whatever you can of armed force and of mounted pickets at the frontier, whereby you may frighten the enemy of Allah and your enemy and others beside them, whom you know not, but Allah knows them. And whatever you spend in the way of Allah, it shall be repaid to you in full, and you shall not be wronged. And if they incline towards peace, incline thou also towards it, and put thy trust in Allah. Surely it is He who is all-hearing, all-knowing. And if they intend to deceive thee, then surely Allah is sufficient for thee. He it is who has strengthened thee with His help and with the believers. And He has put affection between their hearts. If thou hadst expended all that is in the earth, thou couldst not have put affection between their hearts. But Allah has put affection between them. Surely He is mighty, wise. O Prophet, Allah is sufficient for thee and for those who follow thee of the believers. O Prophet, wait a minute, how far am I going here? Yeah, 76. O Prophet, urge the believers to fight. If there be of you 20 who are steadfast, they shall overcome 200. And if there be 100 of you, they shall overcome 1,000 of those who disbelieve, because they are a people who do not understand. For the present, Allah has lightened your burden, for He knows that there is weakness in you. So if there be 100 of you who are steadfast, they shall overcome 200. And if there be 1,000 of you, they shall overcome 2,000 by the command of Allah, and Allah is with those who are steadfast. It does not behoove a prophet that he should have captives until he engages in regular fighting in the land. You desire the goods of the world, while Allah desires for you the hereafter, and Allah is mighty and wise. Had there not been a decree from Allah, which had gone before, great distress would have surely overtaken you in connection with that which you took. So eat of that which you have won in war as lawful and good, and fear Allah. Surely Allah is most forgiving and merciful. O Prophet, say to the captives who are in your hands, if Allah knows any good in your hearts, He will give you better than that which has been taken from you, and will forgive you, and Allah is most forgiving and merciful. And if they intend to deal treacherously with thee, they have already dealt treacherously with Allah before. But He gave thee power over them, and Allah is all-knowing, wise. Surely those who have believed and fled from their homes, and striven with their property and their persons for the cause of Allah, and those who have given them shelter and help, these are friends of one another. But as for those who have believed but have not left their homes, you are not at all responsible for their protection until they leave their homes. But if they seek your help in the matter of religion, then it is your duty to help them, except against the people between whom and yourselves there is a treaty, and Allah sees what you do. And those who disbelieve, they are friends of one another. If you do not, there will be mischief in the land and a great disorder. If you do it not. And those who have believed and left their homes and striven for the cause of Allah, and those who have given them shelter and help, these indeed are true believers. For them is forgiveness and an honorable provision. And those who have believed since then and have left their homes and striven for the cause of Allah along with you, these are of you and as blood relations. They are nearer to one another in the book of Allah. Surely Allah knows all things well. Okay. That's a long one. Okay, but anyway, we have all these people who were leaving their homes, fighting in the cause of Allah, of what to do in the case of people who aid them, what to do in the case of people who were too timid to leave their homes and whatnot, how to handle captives, the whole business. Okay, Surah number 9 now, verses 4 through 6. Excepting those of the idolaters with whom you have entered into a treaty and who have not subsequently failed you in anything nor aided anyone against you. Oh, sorry, that's the previous sentence. I knew that didn't make much sense. Talking about Allah will give tidings of a painful punishment to those who disbelieve, excepting those of the idolaters with whom you have entered into a treaty and who have not subsequently failed you in anything nor aided anyone against you. So fulfill to these the treaty you have made with them till their term. Surely Allah loves those who are righteous. And when the forbidden months have passed, kill the idolaters wherever you find them, and take them prisoners, and beleaguer them, and lie in wait for them at every place of ambush. But if they repent and observe prayer and pay the zakat and leave their way free, surely Allah is most forgiving, merciful. And if any one of the idolaters asks protection of thee, grant him protection so that he may hear the word of Allah, then convey him to his place of security. That is because they are a people who have no knowledge. Okay. Still in Surah number 9, verse 29. Fight those from among the people of the book who believe not in Allah, nor in the last day, nor hold as unlawful what Allah and His Messenger have declared to be unlawful, nor follow the true religion until they pay the tax with their own hand and acknowledge their subjugation.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Yeah.
First of all, none of the quotes that you're reading, they don't seem to have the word jihad in it.
I have pulled out everything having to having to do with jihad, whether it has the word jihad. I'm not sure. When you see the in this translation, I think when you see the translation strive or strife or something, that I think that would be a translation of jihad. But I've pulled out everything having to do with the topic, whether the word itself appears or not.
Okay. The other thing, the thing you just read, sounds like he has pulled away from the idea of the people of the book. Isn't he saying that, you know, the Christians and the Jews or may be the people of the book, but if they don't sign on with Islam, then we can kill them?
It starts off that way, and then it, I mean, you're right, Marty. I mean, that's exactly, those are the people of the book, right? I'll read it again. Fight those from among the people of the book, i.e. Jews and Christians, who believe, and of course they don't, well, they believe in Allah, I guess, but they, and the last day, but they wouldn't, you know, believe in all of the dictates of Islam, for example, that Muhammad is the seal of the prophets and that you need to visit Mecca, you know, that sort of stuff. Nor hold as unlawful what Allah and His Messenger have declared to be unlawful. Okay, fine. Nor follow the true religion. Okay, right. So fight them. But then there's this clause at the end here. Until they pay the tax with their own hand and acknowledge their subjection. So that sounds like, yeah, you're going to fight them and subdue them, but they don't get executed for being non-Muslim. They have to pay a tax. And that's, in fact, what did happen in the Middle Ages. The non-Muslims would pay a special tax, and they would have to acknowledge their subjection, it says.
Oh, I thought that the idea of the tax was metaphorical, meaning that they would pay by punishment if they didn't totally sign up.
I get it. You know, of course, that depends on how you interpret it, but it could be interpreted literally, and in fact, it was interpreted literally. You know, in the Middle Ages, by the tax that was imposed on Christians, for example. But I mean, I could see it. You could take it metaphorically too, if you wanted to. I mean, maybe Al Qaeda does, you know. But yeah. But it's interesting how it does indeed relate to the other people of the book, and Jews and Christians would be the targets here. 36 through 37, same surah. 36 to 37. The reckoning of the months with Allah has been 12 months by Allah's ordinance since the day when He created the heavens and the earth. Of these, four are sacred. That is the right creed. So wrong not yourselves therein. And fight the idolaters all together as they fight you all together. Know that Allah is with the righteous. Surely the postponement of a sacred month is an addition to disbelief. Those who disbelieve are led astray thereby. They allow it one year and forbid it another year, that they may agree in the number of months which Allah has made sacred, and thus they make lawful what Allah has forbidden. The evil of their deeds is made to seem fair to them, and Allah guides not the disbelieving people. Okay, well, I don't know. That has to do with fight the idolaters as they fight you all together. That's the only thing really in there that's relevant, I think. 83 through 84 is still in the same surah. 83 through 84. Let's see now. And if Allah return thee to a party of them, and they ask of thee, leave them, go forth to fight. I'm sorry, let me read this better. And if Allah return thee to a party of them, and they ask of thee leave to go forth to fight, say then, you shall never go forth with me, and you shall never fight an enemy with me. You chose to sit at home the first time, so sit now with those who remain behind. And never pray thou for any of them that dies, nor stand by his grave, for they disbelieved in Allah and his messenger, and died while they were disobedient. So this would be people. I mean, this is clearly stuff that was going on, right? He's writing in reaction to contemporary events. These would be people who sat at home the first time and didn't engage in the fight, didn't leave their home, as he had said in a previous surah that I was reading, didn't engage in the fight, and belatedly they come along and say, oh, I think we want to join you guys. Now, too late, buddy. Just stay right there, and you could just die there. And by the way, we're not going to pray for you once you're dead, because you chickened out the first time.
Okay. Hey, Don.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah. So getting back to Marty's question on the tax, I was reading that the initially the tax was really used for protection, and you could actually get out of the tax if you did military service, if you were non-Muslim.
Uh-huh.
And the tax also, if you paid the tax, you're supposed to be guaranteed protection, mm-hmm, by the Muslims from attacks like the Byzantines or from others.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a couple of cases where they failed to provide that protection, and the Muslim rulers returned the tax,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
to the people.
Yeah. So,
obviously, by like the 8th century, it began to be interpreted a little bit more, should we say, aggressively,
mm-hmm,
on Jews and Christians. Mm-hmm. But before then, it was actually, you know, there are ways of getting around it. You could also do work for the poor, and that would get you out of having to pay the tax.
Mm.
And there was actually a tax on rich Muslims, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. The big complaint, you know, I have to tell you a story, too. But anyway, the big complaint, though, is that you definitely had second-class citizens, right? They were second-class citizens. They had to do things, because they were not Muslim, that Muslims did not have to do. And that was always, of course, a sore point among, like, the Greeks, for example. You know, I have to tell you this story. This shows you. I had this woman, this is back when I was teaching at George Mason, back in the early 80s, and I was teaching ancient philosophy, and I had a Greek woman in my class who, I don't know how typical she was of other Greeks, really, but she was definitely a Greek nationalist. I mean, it didn't matter that Plato and Aristotle didn't agree on various things, because they were Greek, it was perfect. Of course, I'm biased too, but, you know, I do acknowledge that there are disagreements there. Anything Greek was good. Anything else was not good. But anyway, we got to this part. We were doing Aristotle's Ethics. And when you get to Book 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics, he talks about brutish people. And he talks about superhuman virtue and brutishness as sort of two really wild extremes, greater than virtue and worse than vice. And she raised her hand and she said, "Oh, I understand what he meant about brutish people. They're like the Turks," she said. So, like I say, you know, there's this deep-seated antipathy toward, I mean, of course, they were under the thumb of the Ottomans for centuries, and, you know, and they just don't like the Turks, just because they're Turks. So anyway, but that just reminded me, when Pat said, it reminded me of that story, and, you know, because they were second-class citizens, and that breeds resentment, as you know. All right, now where was I? Let's see, I was 80. Oh, yeah. And then 111 is the last. I read that one, right? I read 83 through 84, didn't I? Yeah, I read that one. And so 111 is the last one in this surah. Surely Allah has purchased of the believers their persons and their property in return for the garden they shall have. They fight in the cause of Allah, and they slay and are slain. A promise that he has made incumbent on himself in the Torah and in the Gospel and in the Quran. And who is more faithful to his promise than Allah? Rejoice then in your bargain, which you have made with him, that it is, which is the supreme triumph. Okay. So that's all of Surah number 9. Now the next one, Surah number 33, 27 through 28. Now, this one I have not looked ahead, just to make sure that this looks okay there. And he brought those of the people of the book who aided them down from their fortresses and cast terror into their hearts. Some you slew and some you took captive. And he made you inherit their land and their houses and their wealth and a land on which you had never set foot. And Allah has power over all things. So, good for you. You took the land and the wealth and everything else from the people of the book. Hey, Allah is on your side. Okay? Also, Surah number 33, 61 through 62, I have. Okay? If the hypocrites and those in whose heart is a disease, and those who cause agitation in the city, desist not, we shall surely give the authority over them. Then they will not dwell therein as thy neighbors, save for a little while. Then they will be accursed. Wherever they are found, they will be seized and cut into pieces. Okay, well, that's violent. Okay, Surah number 47, 5 through 7 is what I have. 47. 5 through 7. Hang on, let me just make sure that that's right. Yeah, I think so. Let's see. And when you meet in regular battle, those who disbelieve, smite their necks, and when you have overcome them, bind fast the fetters. And then afterwards, either release them as a favor or by taking ransom until the war lays down its burdens. That is the ordinance. And if Allah has so, and if Allah had so pleased, he could have punished them himself. But he has willed that he may try some of you by others. And those who were killed in the way of Allah, he will never render their works vain. He will guide them and improve their condition and admit them into the garden which he has made known to them. So those will be the martyrs. Allah could have done this all by himself if he wanted to, but he wants to, you know, test you out against one another. So that's how things are going that way. 48:16-23 I have. 23. Let me just make sure that's right. Okay, good, yeah. Huh. Actually, maybe I'll go on to 25. Okay, what did I say? 16? Yeah, okay, here we go. Those who had managed to be left behind will say, when you go forth to the spoils that you may get them, let us follow you. They seek to change the decree of Allah, say, you shall not follow us. Thus has Allah said beforehand. Once again, you know, well, you guys didn't help the first time, so tough. Then they will say, nay, but you envy us. Not so, but they understand not, except a little. Say to the desert Arabs who were left behind, you shall be called to fight against the people of mighty valor. You shall fight them until they surrender. Then if you obey, Allah will give you a good reward. But if you turn your backs as you turned your backs before, he will punish you with a painful punishment. There is no blame on the blind, nor is there blame on the lame, nor is there blame on the sick, if they go not forth to fight. And whoso obeys Allah and his messenger, he will make him enter the gardens beneath which streams flow. But whoso turns his back, him he will punish with a grievous punishment. Surely Allah is well pleased with the believers when they were swearing allegiance to thee under the tree, and he knew what was in their hearts, and he sent down tranquility on them, and he rewarded them with a victory near at hand, and great spoils that they will, and great spoils that they will take. And Allah is mighty, wise. Allah has promised you great spoils that you will take, and he has given you this in advance, and he has restrained the hands of men from you, that it may be a sign for the believers, and that he may guide you on a right path. And he has promised you another victory, which you have not yet been able to achieve, but Allah has surely encompassed it, and Allah has power over all things. And if those who... This almost is like, reads like a, you know, like a speech right before, you know, like Henry V, you know, right before the battle or something. He's promised you a great victory, and, you know, Allah has already figured all this out, destined it at all. And if those who disbelieve should fight you, they would certainly turn their backs. Then they would find neither protector nor helper. Such is the law of Allah that has been in operation before, and thou shalt not find any change in the law of Allah. And it is he who withheld their hands from you and your hands from them in the valley of Mecca after he had given you victory over them, and Allah sees all that you do. It is they who disbelieved and hindered you from the sacred mosque and the offering which was prevented from reaching its place of sacrifice. And had it not been for believing men and believing women whom you knew not and whom you might have trampled down so that harm might have come to you on their account unknowingly, he would have permitted you to fight, but he did not do so, that he might admit into his mercy whom he will. If they had been separated from the disbelievers, we would have surely punished those of them who disbelieved with the grievous punishment. Yeah, so that goes through 26, I believe. That was, I went all the way through, yeah. 40. It was 48? Yeah, 48, 26. Okay, 57:11, my next one. Okay. And why is it that you spend not in the way of Allah While to Allah belongs the heritage of the heavens and the earth, those of you who spent and fought before the victory are not equal to those who did so later. They are greater in rank than those who spent and fought afterwards. And to all that Allah has promised good, and to all has Allah promised good, and Allah is well aware of what you do. All right, let's see. Those of you who spent and fought before the victory are not equal to those who did so later. They are greater in rank than those who spent and fought afterwards. I'm not sure I can penetrate that. He must be talking about three stages along, maybe three different battles or something, and the most important one, I suppose, was the one in the middle. I guess that's what that means. 59:7-9. And whatever Allah has given to His Messenger as spoils from them, you urge neither horse nor camel for that. But Allah grants power to His Messenger over whomsoever He pleases, and Allah has power over all things. Whatever Allah has given to His Messenger as spoils from the people of the towns is for Allah and for the Messenger and for the near kin and the orphans and the needy and the wayfarer, that it may not circulate only among those of you who are rich. And whatsoever the Messenger gives you, take it. And whatsoever He forbids you, abstain from that. And fear Allah, surely Allah is severe in retribution. These spoils are for the poor refugees who have been driven out from their homes and their possessions while seeking grace from Allah and His pleasure and helping Allah and His Messenger. These it is who are true in their faith. It is interesting, I think, that how it's all these are Allah and His Messenger. I mean, I, who happen to be reporting the words of God, also am the one who is sort of authoritatively, you know, parceling out the spoils of war. Everything is for Allah and moi. 61:5 is the next one.
Don, who are you saying the messenger is?
Muhammad.
That's Muhammad.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's saying to share the spoils of war with those who are injured, right? The poor.
The poor. Yeah. Exactly. In other words, I will. You know, everything is for God and myself, and then I will decide how to dole things out on the basis of need or what have you.
Right.
I mean, he was pretty well off by the end of all this when he finally died in 632. 61:5. Verily, Allah loves those who fight in His cause arrayed in solid ranks as though they were a strong structure cemented with molten lead. And that's it. Yeah, that's the last one. Okay. So, I've read all, I think it was 21 verses in the Quran having to do in some way with fighting, whether the word jihad or striving actually appeared there literally or not. That, as far as I know, is you heard a complete inventory of what's in the Quran. So we have our four hypotheses, right? Violence is essential to Islam. It's essentially a violent religion. Oh, no, it's just a matter of changing the heart and fighting against temptation and so forth. It's just war theory, or it's the mosque militant, the crusade. We're going to keep crusading until the world is converted to Islam, at which point we can, you know, we can back off. Okay? Yes.
You mentioned all of these that you've read today, and the ones I remember from last week were all pretty... having to do with actual war, actual fighting.
Yeah,
I've forgotten the few that were more of a struggle to submit the struggle to be a better Muslim.
I think you've forgotten it because there aren't any.
There aren't any?
I don't recall any that, I mean, that, in order to pull that out, you'd have to interpret them allegorically. Does anybody remember any? I don't think there have been any. I mean, Pat Nevins-Locke last week said something along those lines. I haven't heard anything about psychology at all here, and I replied exactly the same way I replied just now. No, you'd have to really allegorize fairly heavily to get that out of there. So unless you're willing to really go headstrong into the realm of allegory, be your Islamic origin, say, you know, who is a fan of allegory, then it's, you know, it's kind of hard to get the psychological part out of it, or the psychological interpretation out of it.
Well, when I, last week you mentioned this group that I was in that started doing the Quran before you did it, or about the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't know you were going to do it. Well, they have given it up because they got tired of it.
I know.
But I'm getting it anyway from this class.
Right.
But we all had Qurans.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I'm thinking of the introduction. We got them from a friend of one of the girls who is a devout Muslim.
Okay.
And she got from her imam free copies for us all.
Mm.
And there was what sounded to me like an extremely orthodox interpretation a long bit before we even started reading, where whoever had done this translation was talking about what you were going to find.
Mm.
And he, like you, realized that jihad is a thing that sticks in the craw of Americans. And he was emphasizing, presumably he, that it was primarily meant to be an internal struggle to be a better Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he's obviously a more moderate type who wanted those of us who were reading a translation to think better of it.
Yes. So, but you've seen the evidence. I mean, as I say, you would have to certainly take this as one gigantic allegory, which is a little hard to, well, I'm biasing things, I guess, but I mean, if you put this in a historical context and you say, well, it's not surprising that all these passages having to do with violence come from the later surahs when, you know, when there in fact was violence going on, and when so much of the Quran seems to reflect Muhammad's actual situation, his actual historical situation. You know, when he talks about, you know, and imputes it to Abraham and imputes it to Moses and imputes it to Jethro and all that sort of thing. You know, people saying, our ancestors forever have worshipped many gods and you're telling us we've been wrong all these hundreds of years? Well, you know good and well that those were arguments that Muhammad himself faced in his discussions with his fellow Meccans. And they are being then projected onto these figures in the past. So in other words, at least the way I'm reading it, is that so much of this is reflective of the actual historical situation Muhammad was in at the time that it was composed, or revealed, as he says. And so if that's the case, then all the stuff about violence and stuff fits right in with that interpretation, because that's what was going on the last 10 years of Muhammad's life. So, of course, you're going to have lots of references to fighting and the whole deal. But, Marty, yeah, that's interesting that that introduction says that, because, of course, I've heard that, read that. But when you look at the evidence right here, I doubt that your translator is the same as my translator. So it would be interesting, actually, this is translated by Maulawi Sher Ali. It would be interesting to take those same passages, and then if that introduction was by the translator himself, it may not have been, but anyway, to look at a translation that where jihad is advertised as a psychological struggle. I would like to see that. But other comments?
Don, could you go back to 862,
okay,
which refers to people inclined toward peace?
862.
I'm not quite sure how to interpret that in the context of those.
Oh, and if they... Oh, do you have my translation?
By no.
How did you know it was 62?
I have something on the web.
Oh, okay.
It actually says 61, but I knew I was supposed to...
Right. Yeah. Okay, very good. Okay, and if they incline towards peace, incline thou also towards it, and put thy trust in Allah, surely is he who is all-hearing, all-knowing. Okay, so in other words... So what's the question?
That sounds... I mean, to me, that's not... You know, violence is inherent here. You need to struggle against those who disbelieve, right? A couple of verses before that, it's... those who disbelieve will not escape or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if they're inclined toward peace, then we're all good.
Mm-hmm. I think as long as... Well, yeah. Now, are we going to stay satisfied if they incline toward peace and yet they're not going to accept Islam? I mean, is this a second chance type thing?
Right.
Or is this we'll just live and let live type thing? If it's a live and let live type thing, then hypothesis number four is wrong. Because hypothesis number four is your hypothesis, by the way.
Right.
The crusader thing. We're not going to stop until the world is Islamic. And there are other things I read just today, which are along the lines of, let's give them a second chance and so forth. You know, don't kill them just yet. So I would be inclined, I guess, to take it as a second chance type thing. That's my inclination anyway.
I just grabbed my little translation.
Yeah.
And I'm just flipping through it. It's when I was actually reading it myself, and I had circled in the first surah, the cow or the heifer.
The number two, actually.
At 62, it says the believers, the Jews, the Christians, and the Sabians, all those who believe in God and the last day and do good deeds, will be rewarded by their Lord. They shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
Right. I think I read that one some time ago. And, you know, that I read that under the... And remember back when we were talking about... I think it was the... we were talking about salvation. And we were talking about works, I think, maybe. Or maybe it was belief. No, it was belief. And I talked about other religions, and especially... Judaism and Christianity, I mean. And, remember we said, and you said even at the time, at the very end of that, I said, which is it? Is he saying that those of us who belong to other religions are out of luck? The whole situation is hopeless? Or is he saying God recognizes there are theological differences among you? Forget it. Don't worry about it. Let God sort it out at the last day. And that sounds more hopeful. And what you just read is of the latter ilk. But there are other passages in there that make it sound like if you're not Muslim, tough luck for you. And you said yourself, and I agree, you said yourself, I don't know which way it is. It just sounds totally ambiguous. I think it is. I have no answer for that one. But it's clearly related to this question of violence and fighting and jihad and so forth, even though that particular verse is not, you know, doesn't use those words. But it's related. Don't know. So what do you think, people? Other comments, questions? Well, is there a fifth option?
Donna,
possibility?
Can I make a comment?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think what you read did not emphasize conversion.
No. You know,
for example, in the wars of conquest, like I mentioned earlier, which violates the surah, those wars violate the surah 2 you mentioned last week, you know, no aggression, but they seem to be more about taking over and spreading the Islamic rule mm-hmm. rather than conversions.
Well, there was some.
I mean, there's a big, that's a big difference in true. The crusader taking over the territory and running it versus the religious conversion.
Okay, good point. Okay, then we need to add a fifth one, maybe a crusader version that's just political versus a religious thing where we there were some.
Well, you would still run under Islamic rule,
right? But that's different.
But it wouldn't be your for you know convert or die.
Yeah, exactly. There were, but I have to go back. I did read a few, but you're right. The overwhelming, it wasn't really emphasized that much, but there were a few having to do with getting disbelievers to believe. You know, hold off. You know. Sign a treaty or something, and maybe they'll see the light because they're not, you know, they just are ignorant. There was some of that in there. But yeah, that's a possible fifth theory. Well, I tell you what, we're almost out of time. Stew over this. What I'm going to do in the remainder, we will continue through the month of May. I figure that maybe Jenny's last day, we don't, you know, we can stop the week before that, which I think is the first day of June, first Sunday of June. What I'm going to do is pull out some stuff from my Islamic theology and philosophy notes and whatnot, and say something about, you know, how all this is interpreted later on, and we'll get to as far as we get, as long as it takes us. What this is, well, only another month and a half left anyway, so we'll have maybe 6 weeks. But think about, now we have five theories. Think about it, and then we can take a vote next week, okay? We'll vote next week on which of the five theories. Once again, violence is endemic, psychology, just war, convert the world, conquer the world without necessarily converting. Those are the five theories. So maybe I'll send out a little email, okay? All right. So anyway, we got to quit, though. We're almost out of time. So see you next week. Bye-bye.
John.
Yes.
John.